Support for NPR comes from MasterCard. World MasterCard is designed to give you access to a world of possibilities. Learn more at priceless.com/world. From Universal Pictures, presenting Changeling, starring Angelina Jolie and John Malkovich, and directed by Clint Eastwood, now in select theaters. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Three of the five books nominated for a National Book Award in the nonfiction category are about the repercussions of war. The winners will be announced November 19th. We're going to hear from the authors of two of those nonfiction nominees. Our first guest, Jane Mayer, is the author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. She writes, quote, "As part of the war on terror, for the first time in its history, the United States has sanctioned government officials to physically and psychologically torment American-held captives, making torture the official law of the land in all but name," unquote. According to her book, the International Committee of the Red Cross has used the word torture to describe some of the U.S. interrogation techniques. Mayer writes about those interrogations and how the vice president made sure that White House and Justice Department lawyers came up with legal justification for them and for the overall expansion of government powers in the war on terror. Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. We spoke last July when her book was published. I asked her about the surprising origins of the extreme interrogation techniques. One of the amazing things about the interrogation program is that the techniques that the CIA used were largely based on a program called SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. This was a Cold War program that was initiated during the Korean War that was used to subject American soldiers to the kinds of harsh interrogation techniques that they might be subjected to if captured so that they'd learn how to resist them. And one of the reasons why this program was put into effect was that 36 American soldiers who were tortured by the Koreans during the Korean War gave false confessions. And so our program is based on techniques that were used and ended up getting false confessions from American soldiers.
It's an incredible irony. I looked around as a reporter and thought, why is it that we're seeing the same strange techniques being used on detainees in all the places where the U.S. is holding them? I mean, it was true in Guantanamo, it was true in Iraq, and it was true in Afghanistan. You'd see people hooded and shackled in a certain way, deprived of sleep, bombarded with really loud, horrible sounds. And there seemed to be a program. I didn't think it was possible that U.S. soldiers could have just kind of freelanced this and come up with it in exactly the same way all around the world. And so I was looking to see, is there a curriculum for this? And what I found was, in fact, there was a rule book for it. And the rule book was an arcane program, a secret program that's run for the special forces down in Fort Bragg, and actually the other services also have it. Fort Bragg is the Army. The Navy has a version, and the Air Force has a version, too. And what this program was for was to recreate torture as it had existed during the Cold War, communist torture, in order to prepare soldiers in case they are ever taken captive so that they could survive and resist it. And these programs became sort of like, I thought of them as like little Petri dishes where they kept the virus alive in order to inoculate soldiers against it. But what happened in the War on Terror was that the people who ran those programs wound up being turned to as experts on how to interrogate people. And that little virus in the Petri dish got out and spread through the United States military and through the CIA. So it became actually the curriculum for how we were going to interrogate people ourselves. And it was something that had been used originally to get false confessions out of people by communists, so that we wound up emulating the tactics of what we called the evil empire. And it had never been designed to get the truth. It had always been used to get false confessions. And inevitably, of course, what happened was we wound up getting a lot of false intelligence out of people.
So the premise was, if you subject somebody to enough pain, they'll tell you whatever you want to hear.
Well, that's the idea. And it's not just pain, actually. The program that they emulated, is also one of psychological destruction. It's as much psychological as it is physical, really.
Such as?
They did a lot of psychological research during the Cold War years in the CIA to try to figure out what made people give false confessions and whether there was some kind of brainwashing. And what they found out was that if you subject people to severe isolation, where you really cut them off from all stimuli, you give them goggles, you give them, cover up their hands so they can't feel anything, keep them in the dark, they don't know what time it is, they can't talk to anybody, they even tried suspending people in water tanks, you give them white noise, before long, people go crazy. And they also become very dependent upon their captors and bond with them. And the idea was that we can manipulate them psychologically in order to get them to talk to their interrogators because they're going to be so desperate to have some kind of human bond. And so that kind of research was went into our Cold War CIA science experiments and it wound up being taken back off the shelf. The reason that we turned to these arcane and exotic programs was that, in truth, the CIA had not had a lot of experience interrogating people. The CIA before 9/11 didn't hold prisoners. That was the province of the criminal justice system in this country and the military. And the military and the criminal justice system had very strict rules for what you could do. But suddenly after 9/11, the CIA had its own prisoners and didn't really know how to interrogate them. And they turned to the wrong people.
So, you know, you can understand why certain communist governments wanted false confessions. They want you to say, basically, I have sinned and the communist government is great, you know, to say that on the record.
Right. It's very useful for propaganda purposes.
Exactly. But theoretically, that's not what the Bush administration wanted. It wanted real information about real terrorists. Is there any evidence that we've gotten any real information about real terrorists and terrorist plots through these interrogation techniques?
The record of what the Bush administration got out of the terror suspects who they tortured or coerced or used enhanced interrogation techniques, call it whatever you want, is secret still. We have not been able to examine the record. We don't have the interrogation transcripts. But those who have seen them have raised a lot of really disturbing problems about what they've produced. For instance, Jay Rockefeller, who is the senator who is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, put out a statement not so long ago saying, from everything he knows, and he knows as much as almost anyone about this program, there's never been a reason to torture anyone. There's no reason that they needed to move to these techniques.
You know, in discussing the Bush administration and al-Qaeda, you describe how the Bush administration kind of swung from one extreme to another, that before September 11th, the Bush administration was either ignoring or downplaying all the information it was getting about the threats of al-Qaeda, and it got a lot of information. But then after September 11th, the Bush administration became obsessed with al-Qaeda and doing absolutely anything to stop them, including what many people believe is the torture of detainees. And you write about Vice President Cheney in particular here, about how a lot of people close to him felt that he became paranoid, in part because he insisted on reading the intelligence firsthand. You say he distrusted the CIA and he wanted to see the information firsthand, but he was getting that information unfiltered, unscreened. Why was that a problem?
I'm so glad you asked about this, because I actually think it's a really interesting dynamic that took place in the Bush White House right after 9/11, which was that both Cheney and Bush, but Cheney in particular, wanted to see what's known as raw intelligence. They didn't want it analyzed by the CIA, and they wanted to see everything. And what this meant was that they were just completely bombarded with all kinds of horrible possible threats from all around the world. Everything the United States government was able to sort of vacuum up of enemy actions against the United States. And what experts said to me, intelligence experts said to me, I quote Roger Cressy is one of them in this book, who was at the National Security Council, they thought it was a big mistake, because what the vice president and president were getting was a lot of bad information. You get a lot of bad information with the good, a lot of unreliable reports that would be everything from people plotting nuclear attacks on the U.S. to anthrax attacks, all kinds of awful things. But the president and the vice president started every day looking at this stuff. And a number of people who saw these reports, they were called the Threat Matrix Report, felt that it really tainted their outlook in a way that might have almost thrown off their judgment.
Because they were taking all of the false information mixed in with the real information and considering everything a threat, even if it was just junk.
Right. I mean, and ordinarily, what in the past, what the CIA has done is had morning briefings, of course, with presidents, but they only present what they feel is reliable and really worrisome. In this case, they just threw the whole kitchen sink in, and it was full of stuff that you know, came from, you know, people phoning it in because they imagined they saw something awful when, you know, who knows whether it was or not. There was no work done to try to evaluate the intelligence. It was just all just thrown at the president and vice president. And people who knew Cheney for a long time, I talked to one man who was a longtime family friend of the Cheneys and really likes Cheney a lot. But he said that after 9/11, he changed. He just seemed steely, and he has a pretty, known for having a really good sense of humor, actually, but it was as if he had seen something terrible, this man said to me. I think also that it's very hard for anybody outside of the government to be able to understand the amount of responsibility and worry that they felt that if they didn't do everything they possibly could, America was going to be hit by a terrorist attack again, maybe a worse one, maybe even a nuclear attack. I mean, they had to live with this responsibility. And I've tried in the book to at least understand them and give them credit for trying to protect the country. They it's not that they were a gang of criminals who were doing something wanton for fun. These are people who felt they were doing what was required and necessary to protect the country. But and so they just went to extraordinary lengths, and I think that what happened was, as it became more clear that many people felt they'd gone too far, they couldn't turn back.
At the end of your book, you write, what began on 9/11 as a battle for America's security became and continues to be a battle for the country's soul. I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that.
Well, this is really very much why I wanted to write this book, was I felt that while I was writing stories about torture and rendition and some of this, the extreme practices in the war on terror that seemed so depressing, people would say to me, why, how can you write about this stuff? It's so depressing. And in truth, what I knew was that all along the way, there were people who were standing up against it, who were, in my view, very patriotic, and who felt that this was there was another front in the war on terror. It wasn't just the U.S. versus the terrorists. There was also kind of a civil war inside America, which was this battle for America's soul. And there were a lot of people who just felt in the military that this wasn't right, and that we faced worse enemies and not descended to their level like this. There were a lot of people in the FBI who stood up and said, we're not doing this. We don't torture people. That's what our enemies do. And spoke out internally. There were a number of lawyers in the Bush White House who did so too. And I guess I felt that there was a real live battle, an incredibly interesting struggle going on to define how do we keep the country safe without mortgaging our ideals. And I what I wanted to tell partly in this book was the story of that fight. It's a fight that's really a moral fight, an ethical fight, a historic fight, and I think something that I really wanted the country to think about, know about. So that's what I meant about the struggle for America's soul.
My guest is Jane Mayer, the author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jane Mayer is the author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It's nominated for the 2008 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Part of your book is about how dissent within the Bush administration, about how we were dealing with secret detention facilities and interrogation that many people have described as torture, how dissent about that within the Bush administration was squashed. Give us some of the more extreme examples of how that was stopped.
Well, almost from the start, there were people who said when these extreme ways of treating prisoners were proposed, they said, you know, this is outside of America's tradition. Since George Washington, we have been leading the cause of human rights and particularly in the treatment of prisoners of war. We've always tried to be the most humane country in the world. When lawyers in the administration tried to stand up for what they thought was the law, and it was a different interpretation from that from Cheney's office in particular, they often found themselves ostracized and careers came to an end. Some of the lawyers felt themselves to be in such danger, really. They feared retribution from the vice president's office to the point where two of them actually resorted to having to talk in codes, and they thought they might be in physical danger. And those two were Jack Goldsmith, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, and James Comey, who was the number two guy in the Justice Department, the Deputy Attorney General. And both of them were busy trying to withdraw the torture statute and fix the law on this area, but they really just became, you know, almost paranoid about whether they could do this without facing danger.
Now, you write that there was a group of Bush administration lawyers who wanted to challenge the SEER program, and that's the Cold War program of interrogations that the Gitmo model was based on that we were talking about a little earlier. And the radical plan of action that this group of Bush administration lawyers drew up to oppose the SEER program was called the Big Bang. So they wanted to shut down the secret detention centers and shut down the interrogation program. What was the plan and why did it fizzle?
The Big Bang was, I mean, the reason they called that was they thought that it was going to take the bureaucratic equivalent of dynamite to blow up this program. They had tried to work through the channels in the White House, and every time they tried to get anywhere, they got squelched by Vice President Cheney and his office really seemed to kind of control these issues. And so they decided they were going to have to try to go behind the vice president's back. And they met in secret in the Pentagon one weekend and drew up a plan that was going to be a potential speech for Bush to give, closing down the CIA's black prison sites, transferring their prisoners to Guantanamo, and calling for an end to Guantanamo eventually, and putting everybody on trial so that they finally had some kind of due process. And what they drafted a very eloquent plan and speech, and they were going to give one copy to Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, and the other copy was going to go to Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. And they hoped then that those cabinet secretaries would be able to give it to the president going around the vice president. So what happened was the first part of the plan worked well. Condoleezza Rice really liked it, and she was ready to try to get on board and give it to President Bush. But Rumsfeld was absolutely furious that they had done this without consulting him. And in fact, they felt really in truth that he just opposed the plan, but used this sort of bureaucratic anger to try to shut it down. And so when a meeting was scheduled to discuss the Big Bang plan in the National Security Council and Rice was going to try to discuss it, Rumsfeld said he absolutely refused to participate unless they would not discuss that subject. They could talk about Guantanamo, but they couldn't talk about the Big Bang. So it died on the vine. And, many people wondered how much of the information that was critical of these programs really reached President Bush. They felt often that the vice president kind of strangled the paper flow so that the president really didn't learn about a lot of the problems in these programs.
In the story, the way you tell it, Vice President Cheney really emerges as the the kind of commander of the war on terror, not of the troops, but just of the overall strategy. And his chief counsel, David Addington, is the legal mind expanding executive authority to make all this happen. And although it's expanding executive authority, presidential authority, it's really Vice President Cheney who's doing all of the analytical work to make it happen rather than the president himself. The president himself is just signing off on it. An accurate representation of the picture the way you're describing it?
Yeah, it was an irony to me that basically the argument made by Cheney and his lawyer is always, we need to expand the power of the president. The president gets to decide these issues. But as one of the top White House officials said to me, who was an opponent of this, some of this program, that, you know, he wondered how often did the president really make these decisions, and how many of the decisions were made by Cheney. Frequently, they were made by Cheney. I mean, I did my best to document it, and I think, you know, there's plenty more for historians and other reporters to try to dig up. But you can really see that the fingerprints of the vice president and his office are all over the national security policy.
Jane Mayer, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm so glad to be here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Jane Mayer is the author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It's nominated for a National Book Award for nonfiction. Our interview was recorded in July when the book was published. We'll hear from another nominee in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.